Many of you have asked us questions about the spread of the virus, the rates of infection, and survival. So to give us some answers, we're joined now by NPR science correspondent John Hamilton. Hi, John.
Hi, Ari.
Let's dive right in with this question from a caller in Michigan.
I'm a 68-year-old woman in good health with mild hypertension. If I were to contract COVID-19 and require hospitalization with a respirator, what are my chances of surviving? What is the recovery period?
It's a frightening question to consider and one that so many of you have been asking us. So, John, I know you've been reporting on survival rates. What can you tell us?
Well, there is a short and I'm afraid to say unpleasant answer to Emily's question, and that is that, you know, her chances of survival would not be great. Let me go through a couple of the reasons why that is. I mean, first, there is some good news here. Her mild hypertension, for instance, is not a significant factor. But on the other hand, Emily is 68, and coronavirus is fatal for about 3 to 4% of people between 60 and 70. It's about
twice that. 3 to 4%, okay.
3 to 4%, and it's about twice as high for people between 70 and 80. So that's not good right there. Mm-hmm. But the big risk factor she described is being in the hospital on a ventilator. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think Emily said respirator, which is a mask you wear to filter the air that you breathe. I think what she meant was ventilator.
Yeah.
And that's a device that essentially breathes for you. It is a last resort. You don't end up on a ventilator unless your lungs are in such bad shape they're no longer be able to provide enough oxygen.
I see. So if you have a mild case, you're not likely to need a ventilator. But once you have a ventilator, it's a sign that things may be pretty dire for you.
Right. And so far, the statistics from China and elsewhere suggest that your chances of surviving if you end up on a ventilator are certainly less than 50% and maybe quite a bit less.
All right. Let's take this question from Amy in Watsonville, California, who wants to know about tracking casualties.
I've heard that if you haven't been tested for the virus, your death won't count as a COVID-19 death, which means that the actual numbers are so far below the true counts of who has died as a result of this virus. That also means that every community has no idea how many more actual deaths are to be attributed to this pandemic. And I think if we all knew the true numbers, so many more people would be on board with this physical distancing practices.
That's a really interesting question there from Amy. We've all heard about people who had symptoms but weren't tested. If those people die, are they counted as COVID-19 deaths, John?
Well, so Amy is partly right. It is true that in most countries, you're not classified as a coronavirus patient unless a test shows that you have the virus. So in theory, you know, if you died without being tested, you would not show up in the statistics. But that's not really what's happening, at least in the most of the world. In most countries, the people who are being tested are precisely those people who are so sick they are likely to die. Those people usually end up in the hospital, and hospitals are really aggressive about testing. So It's pretty unlikely that we're missing a whole lot of deaths from coronavirus. On the other hand, we are still missing a whole lot of people who are infected but don't get that sick.
Okay, so the death rate is likely to be more accurate than the infection rate because so many people may be asymptomatic and just never know that they had it. Let's
exactly.
go next to a question from Elizabeth in Portland, Oregon.
What is the government planning, or public health institutions planning to help deal with another surge, given that most people aren't going to be immune and the virus could still spread? Are there ways, are there plans, even while the emergency is happening, to tackle kind of a second surge similar to how they did in South Korea?
Yeah, John, I think a lot of people have been wondering when the social distancing measures end and everybody starts going out to restaurants and bars and being social again, will there be another wave of infections?
It is quite likely. Yes, Elizabeth is right. Most people won't be immune even months from now. So even if we have the virus under control in the U.S., it could easily come back. And that's why there's so much talk about this phrase, you know, flattening the curve. The idea is that if you use measures like social distancing to slow down the spread of the virus, everybody won't get sick at once and overwhelm the hospitals. And you look at places like, you know, South Korea, which you mentioned, and the number of new infections seems to be falling right now, but they still have lots of measures in place to keep people apart, to keep them from getting infected, and they are testing lots and lots of people. So if the virus starts spreading again, they'll probably know, and presumably they'll clamp down again. I know in the U.S., health officials have talked about a second surge of cases, but, you know, at the moment, we're still focused on the first one in places like New York.
So you're saying even when things go back to quote-unquote normal, they might not look like the normal that we had before this broke out in the first place?
Not if you're going to keep the infection in check, no.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned flatten the curve, because our next caller brings up that very question. It's from Denver in Jacksonville, Arizona.
Where I am, there seems to be a completely different reaction to this health crisis. Demand for testing is overwhelmed, and yet grocery store shelves are empty. What is a person supposed to do to be a responsible citizen and help flatten the curve, especially if there isn't any support for us to stay home?
What advice do you have for her, John? How can Denver help flatten the curve in this situation?
Well, you know, flattening the curve is not easy. It requires people doing things that make it difficult to get through daily life. And I think for every person, it really comes down to this. You have to balance out what you need to get through the day with measures you can take to reduce the risk. So, you know, you have to eat. You have to go to the grocery store. But can you do it in a way that minimizes risk? Do you wash your hands? Do you keep track of how your distance from other people? It's a balancing act for everybody.
Well, and also balancing the temptation not to hoard, so you leave things for other people, but also not wanting
toilet
to go to
paper,
the supermarket
yes.
every 3 days.
Exactly.
We have so many good questions coming in. Let's just keep plowing through them. We have one here from Eugene in Indianapolis.
What measurements is the federal government monitoring to let the public understand the effectiveness of the 15 days to slow the virus?
It's a great question. John, how do we know if it's working?
Well, most of what I know from, like a lot of Americans, I've been listening to Dr. Anthony Fauci, sort of the leading right. federal spokesman on coronavirus, right? And he and others have been trying to explain that 15 days, it's a marker. It's not an endpoint. So the idea is that if you change behavior today, you should see some sign of fewer new infections and cases a couple of weeks from now. The problem is you need a whole lot of testing to really know how much impact you're having. And right now, we're only beginning to get enough tests to really make good measurements on our progress.
Well, we have so many more questions that we're not going to have time to get to, but we are here 5 nights a week. So NPR science correspondent John Hamilton, hope we can have you back again soon. Thanks for answering all these questions for us.
My pleasure.